This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. Liverpool and City serve up a treat. Mo Salah's moment of genius. Mo Salah's other moment of genius. Phil Foden flying. Bernardo Silva playing sensible soccer. What a delight. Elsewhere, just how much does Andros Townsend respect Cristiano Ronaldo? If only there was someone we could ask. Can Ole get the best out of this Manchester United team? If only there was someone we could ask. And did Barry eat his butternut squash? If only there was someone we could ask. Also, have the floodgates open for Timo Werner, our Spurs, as Nuno says, now unstoppable. And who had October the 3rd for when Watford would sack their manager in Watford manager bingo? All that, plus Barca pain, waterlogged pitches, your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks for asking. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max.
And welcome to the pod, Troy Townsend. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm okay. I mean, it's a good time to bring me on, to be honest. So really, I'm okay.
Well, I sort of feel that we really, you know, we got you on the pod. You know, we dragged you from obscurity. You came on the pod and then Andros got goal of the month that evening. And then we booked you, and then this weekend he also did okay. So I think it might be the power of the Guardian Football Weekly. In many ways, you and Andros should be indebted to us.
I mean, where did you drag me from? That's the most important question that I'm going to ask at the moment. But of course we're indebted to you, Max. We always have been, and now that you're putting us on another platform, why wouldn't we be?
Oh, thanks very much. Let's start at Anfield. Liverpool 2, Manchester City 2. A brilliant game of football. Jack says, is Barry standing by his Ethan Pinnock goal of the season after Mo Salah's moment of magic today? What a goal that was, Baz.
It was absolutely magnificent. You could sort of set it to classical music. I mean, I was thinking, oh yeah, you could set this to music. But you could set anything to music. You could set Ethan Pinnock's tap into music. But this was just wonderful. One of the best goals I've seen scored in the Premier League or elsewhere. Just the way he left, I don't know, was it three different Manchester City players for dead, two of them more or less sliding into the car park and slotted home. Absolutely beautiful goal.
It's interesting. I've been listening to people on the radio, Troy, compare, you know, start talking about Maradona and Messi. And I don't know if that's ridiculous or if actually in 30 years' time, you know, young Liverpool fans who were at Anfield yesterday will be telling their kids about Mo Salah.
I'm just trying to put together a piece of music. So Barry's got me going now and I'm really trying to think of music that could go towards that piece of art. It's not unusual for Salah. He scored a similar type goal, although not as good as that one yesterday, I think, against Spurs a couple of seasons ago, where he left a couple of defenders for, well, in the car park, as Barry puts it as well. It's the things that he does. I mean, you'll think that Messi and Maradona do it on a more consistent basis in regards to when they leave defenders in their wake. But he's playing at the height of his game. And when he switched on yesterday, he was the one that got Liverpool going. If there's a better goal this season, and I've seen one or two that are not too bad, then, you know, they're going to have to go some to beat that strike. Because, again, they're top-class defenders, top-quality defenders. It was Bernard Silva who decided that he wanted to try and drag pull him down with some scissors kick, which I'm not quite sure what he was doing at that stage. But it's a phenomenal finish. Right foot strike as well. Up there with the very best, for sure.
I mean, that little drag back was a little bit Pushkas on Billy Wright in 1953, and then to then beat Diaz as well. Just an absolutely stunning goal. I mean, I was watching it. I'd been at Spurs, so saw the sort of first half at Spurs, raced down to a mate of a mate's house. So I ended up watching it with six City fans, and they were all sort of just, you know, open mouthed how good it was. I mean, obviously very annoyed to have conceded, but also just going, that was just brilliant.
It was kind of like one of those YouTube clips where you see one or two professional footballers taking on 100 children who just can't get the ball from them. and despite, you know, lunging in and whatnot. So, yeah, it was remarkable. And the quality of opposition, obviously, has to be factored in.
Yeah, actually, Bernardo Silva's run in the first half was even more like that, where it looked like every Liverpool defender was on Bernardo, but he somehow managed to keep the ball. And I think he set Foden up?
He did, yeah.
I mean, Foden had an absolutely brilliant game as well, Troy, didn't he?
I thought first 45 minutes, obviously, he was the player of the match after in that period of time. I think I'd be probably disappointed that he didn't probably put one in the back of the net. But, you know, my focus was more on... I've got to be honest, I couldn't believe that Liverpool started with James Milner at right back again. There must be something about Gomez that, I don't know, he's not come back from his injury very well. And the reason I say that is not because James Milner is not a great professional, but he's had a tough time at right back. I watched him at Liverpool at home to Crystal Palace a few weeks ago, and Wilf Zaha led him a merry dance. And to be fair, the multiple occasions that he dragged down Wilf Zaha and didn't get a yellow card in that game was unbelievable. So, I mean, from Pep's point of view, what a strategy. Rather than Grealish putting Foden out there, and obviously Foden, you know, was in on multiple occasions. Is there at any stage, by the way, that we are going to pay homage to Edison's pass from... I mean, that is the stuff that dreams are made of for any footballer, let alone a goalkeeper. And again, Foden may be disappointed that he didn't finish that one off as well. But he had a magnificent game. I thought he scored at his most quiet period in the game when Liverpool had kind of got on top. But again, a young man that plays at that level, as you say, one of the toughest games that, you know, you could begin to imagine. Unbelievable.
Wilson, was it worth Milner not being sent off just for Pep to get that furious and sort of take his coat off as if he was going to start a fight with Mike Dean, which is, let's face it, I would pay to go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium for that fight above any Anthony Joshua fight. Dean versus Guardiola.
I mean, look, Milner could have been sent off twice. Yeah, he probably committed three yellow card offences, so he should have gone. But also, Pep getting angry is very, very funny. I think it's funnier than any other Premier League manager. Yeah, his histrionics, the way he waves his arms about, the way he kept coming back from what, he kept going back in the second area and then coming out again. And then, yeah, taking the coat off to reveal that horrible sweatshirt. It was an extra layer of seasoning on a magnificent steak.
It is wonderful seeing Pep go full Basil Fawlty as he did yesterday. And what I really loved about it was the fact Mike Dean was the fourth official who just stood there very impassively chewing gum like a bored student in geography class and not rising to the bait at all. And what also interesting that just before Milner took down Bernardo Silva, he was fouled by Jordan Henderson as well. It was, they sort of double tagged him. And then he went down. It was quite clearly a foul. And Henderson, you know, really laid into him. I'd love to know what he was saying, because it was almost as if he was accusing Silva of diving when he quite clearly hadn't. And the other thing about that is the irony of this is Milner wasn't sent off, but up until that point, he might as well not have been on the field. But then the bit where he should have been dismissed from the field, that led to Jurgen Klopp replacing him with someone else. So it was kind of double punishment for Manchester City.
Is it possible to bring some seriousness to this pod for a minute? Just for a minute. I mean, not too long.
Okay.
But I would really love to know what goes through an official's mind at that period of time. Because through the millions watching, through, you know, people doing podcasts like this, I mean, it's a clear yellow, isn't it? It's a clear sending off, you know, because it's his second yellow. At some stage, I don't mean Dermot Gallagher telling us that, yes, he's made a mistake. I mean, at some stage, is there a point where we are told why that wasn't deemed a yellow? Because I find it very, very hard to comprehend that in the grand scheme of things, when they're told, the referees are told what is a yellow, what isn't, you know, what do you pull up and what do you don't. Why he didn't at that stage? And I know Pep believes that it's the Anfield bias, but I don't know. I'd love to get to the bottom of it at some stage.
I genuinely think there's emotion in it. in that James Milner's a really nice guy and he's already had a yellow card. And so I don't want to give him another one. And it's a really good game. And I want to keep it 11 v 11. I mean, I know that is sort of goes against everything a referee should do. But and like, I can't speak for Paul Tierney. He's not here with me. But
I think you should speak for Paul Tierney, like an actor doing Gerry Adams.
Listen, I'm no longer the voice of Gaviscon. I'm looking for voiceover work. If the voice of Paul Tierney, you know, can supplement my income, I'm very happy.
I think this is the compromise solution that referees should explain the decisions, but in your voice.
Okay. Am I all of them, or is it like you get a sort of generic broadcaster, you know, for each referee?
No, it's you have to be all of them, but you have to do each of them in their accent. So go full sort of Scouse Wirral for Mike Dean, Geordie for Clattenburg. I mean, back to a serious note, I kind of agree with you, Max, because we presume emotion doesn't come into it for referees. But increasingly, when referees who are no longer refereeing, whether they've retired or moved abroad like Clattenburg or whatever, when they are interviewed, they all admit that emotion does come into a lot of their decisions. Clattenburg has been doing the rounds recently, plugging a new book. He made a bit of a tit of himself on TalkSport last week, talking about women referees. But, you know, in his book, he admits freely that emotion does come into it. Emotion and a row with Jose Mourinho were kind of more or less behind his decision to go and take that job in Saudi Arabia.
So then we have to understand, we have to appreciate, though, Pep getting emotional as well then. Because there'll be a lot of chrism about Pep this morning, weren't there? About he's gone too far. But we have to obviously appreciate that the emotion then is Pep's reaction to the official's emotion.
Yeah, I don't think he went too far. I think had he taken off that terrible sweatshirt and then swung a haymaker at Mike Dean, and then I would have had to have played the role of an injured Mike Dean in a Scouse accent. I would have had to give myself a black eye as well to play the role of Mike Dean. Barney was writing about Grealish playing centre forward, calling it the footballing equivalent of buying a Mont Blanc fountain pen and using it to peel carrots. I wonder your sort of we don't need to do Manchester City, do they need a striker conversation again, although I'm happy to, but I just wonder what you made of that.
I mean, they sort of do, but also it's more complicated than that. So if there's a trade-off, isn't there, that the way Guardiola wants to play is to control midfield and to have players dropping back from forward line to give extra men in midfield, to give new angles, to enable them to hold possession better. He needs his forward line to press very hard, which, you know, first off, particularly, they did, and they're obviously excellent doing that at Chelsea. Finding a centre forward who can do that is pretty difficult. And Harry Kane probably can, but he's never played in a really hard pressing team. I mean, I guess the times in the Pochettino Spurs were. But that was sort of Kane before the injuries, before he sort of slightly changed how he operates. So it's a question of balance, and you know, if you have one thing, you don't have the other. If you have a pure centre forward who's going to score you 30 goals, maybe he doesn't contribute so much to other parts of the game. But I thought particularly against PSG, you could see how, say they'd signed Lukaku or Kane, then the amount of space between PSG's back seven and their front three, City had all the time in the world to measure crosses in the box. It didn't really matter if you're hitting them at... Who's playing centre forward? Was it Sterling playing centre forward that day?
I think so, yeah.
So somebody who's not going to win balls in the air. And that's not particularly criticism of Sterling, because it would also be true of Grealish or of Foden, maybe even of Ferran Torres, all the players who've played centre forward for City this season. So there are advantages in having a striker, but Pep looks for other stuff, and they won the league last year as top scorers without a centre forward. They got the Champions League final without one.
And before we move on, we should mention Barry Rodri's tackle in injury time, which was absolutely sensational, wasn't it? And he came out of nowhere.
Yeah, Fabinho looked a certainty to score after a rare Edison error. And yeah, Rodri just materialised from nowhere, and it was a match-saving tackle, as important as Salah's goal.
he wanted to go full Chiellini, and there wasn't really anyone there just to do it with him.
I think he could have actually, you know, flown in Leonardo Bonucci, who would have appreciated the beauty of what he'd done and fist-pumped him and hugged him and high-fived him. But
I think you're right. To Old Trafford then, Manchester United 1, Everton 1. Anshuman says, has Andros thanked Troy for single-handedly reviving his form? Father of the year for me already. Lee says, can you just thank Troy for having a sound lad from a happy blue? I presume everybody knows that you are Andros Townsend's dad, Troy. That's not why we booked you, just to be clear about this. Forget punditry and all that. You know, your son scored an equaliser at Old Trafford. What's it like to see your son do that?
Well, he's gone down a bit because last season he scored the opener at Old Trafford. So to score the equaliser is not so good. to be honest with you, so to put it into context, I mean, it was a good game anyway. And Everton were you know, nip and tuck with Man United. And I think the best thing United did for Everton, who were at ease at 1-0, was bring on Ronaldo and Sancho because it opened the game up. And Andros finishes a perfect counter-attack from a Manchester United corner. Just perfect, with the involvement of Damari Gray and Decore. And Andros, you know, seen it yesterday, you know, 90 yards to get into the edge of the box. First touch, second touch, goal. They're the things you can't describe. In the moment, you go mad. So if I'm on the TV screen, you've seen me and I'm going mad, yeah, I apologise. But you just, it's everything that you want. It's everything that you kind of, you know, find it very difficult to put all the emotion and wrap it together. Unbelievable. Deserved goal, deserved point, but so much more. Just the kind of beating of my heart is just goes 10 to the dozen at that stage. And yeah, it was just a very good moment. And luck, Everton are a new set of fans to us, so they are beginning to get to know us, I think. And it was just lovely to be in amongst them at that stage.
The celebration, Barry, was funny, wasn't it?
Well, as you said yesterday, the dismount wasn't great, but it was clearly an homage, as Andros said afterwards, to Cristiano Ronaldo. I'm not so sure about that. And I'm genuinely curious to know if that's what prompted Ronaldo to storm off in a huff at the end of the game. Probably not. There could be any number of things he was angry about. But yeah, I liked it. It's funny.
Adam says, Gray and Townsend look like prime Ribery and Robben. I mean, Wilson, Everton played so well in this game and they were missing, you know, Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison as well.
Yeah, they were really good and probably should have won it. I mean, if Mina had you know, slightly checked his will, or if Tom Davies had been slightly more confident to go himself rather than squaring it, they would have won. I mean, United had far more shots, but Everton won quite comfortably on the XG, which I think tells you something about the inefficiency of how United play. And then, yeah, the counter-attack was, you know, all three components of it were brilliant.
I will be told off if I don't just go back. Troy, have you spoken to Andros about the celebration? Has he said anything? Has he said, yeah, I was ripping the shit out of Ronaldo because I hate him?
I mean, absolutely what he said is what it was. It was, I mean, listen, it came out of the blue. I'm watching him run off to celebrate and just thinking, you know, he's going to get to the corner flag, I don't know, pick it up and do an Elvis song. I wasn't even sure. But the fact that he then obviously tried to do the celebration, and we'll say tried, and as Barry says, you know, didn't dismount very well, did he? No, listen, growing up, you know, the Ronaldos, I'll say, but that this Ronaldo was one that obviously he wanted to kind of perform like and be at the top level like, because of the way that he played the game, the way that he graced the game, his skill. Andros loves a step over, as any player that has played with him will tell you. And he loves a shot as well. So I'm not sure if he had practiced it at all, but he didn't practice it very well. But it definitely was an absolute mark of respect to someone who he obviously has called an icon.
Yeah, I don't believe you. Sean, Sean says, how is it possible for Man United to bring on three of the most expensive Premier League players ever and be worse? Josh says, can we get some T-shirts printed that say Wilson was right with Ronaldo's face on them?
I've got them already, don't worry.
When Man United start languishing behind the title Pat, come the November international break. Should we just get a clip from the last time you were on, or do you just want to repeat it for us? Manchester United, Solskjaer, Ronaldo, etc.
Ronaldo has been a great player. He remains a great finisher. He will score 20, 30 goals this season. He also, he's certainly not the only problem with United, but the balance of the team isn't right. The structure isn't right. They're incredibly vulnerable on the break, quite apart from everything else. I mean, what that goal reminded me of, the equaliser, I mean, it speeded up by a factor of about 100, but it was like the Başakşehir goal last season. United have a corner and suddenly they have no players to stop the counter. And it was a better goal than Başakşehir goal because it featured two players who could actually run. And there were, it did need Doucouré Gray and Doucouré to actually manipulate the ball a bit rather than just running. But if you're persistently conceding goals on the break, it's the same as when Frank Lampard was at Chelsea. It suggests there's something wrong in the composition of the midfield. And the fact that the Mina disallowed goal was from a corner. I think they're the two real red flags. They're the two giveaways that a manager's not structuring the team properly. If you can't defend set plays and you can't defend counters, that's where a defensive coach really earns his corn. And United are vulnerable there.
Brucey says, who would Wilson pick to manage this Manchester United team?
I mean, of the available candidates now, of the people they could realistically get, I think there's two things you can do. You either get Conte in and accept there's going to be sort of a two, three-year whirlwind and things might be difficult at the end of it and accept it's going to be a pretty bumpy ride. But, Conte has a history of success despite the aggravation he always brings. Or you wait for Pochettino to leave PSG and get him.
The Daily Express was saying that Manchester United are getting increasingly interested in Gareth Southgate. I wonder, are you shaking your head, Wilson?
I mean, Southgate is, a really good international manager. But I think the demands of an international manager, the attributes you need are very different to what you need at club level. And I think my criticism of Southgate, I think he's done, fundamentally he's done brilliantly, but I'm not sure he reacts quickly enough within games to change situations. And that catches England out at international level, once a year, say, because it's only once a year that they find themselves in that situation against a good team where they're either trying to defend the lead or trying to get back to a game. Club level, that would be happening, once a fortnight.
Also, they maybe, no one would tell him the games are every week and he'd just turn, he'd only turn up once a month and everyone would be so devastated because it'd be an international break and we'd be like, oh, not again. Am I wrong to be just, I'm so annoyed there's another one, Barry. I'm just getting back into the Premier League now. And I feel sort of childish and pathetic for being as annoyed as I am that we now have another week of what on earth are we going to talk about?
I no problem with international breaks. I think I used to, but I like international football and I like to be able to step off the treadmill every now and then and take an interest in games that I'm not hugely interested in because the international team I support isn't very good and isn't going to qualify for the World Cup. They're more or less already out of contention. But I have no problem with the international break.
I think this is because you're so excited by your new job. I think when you've been doing the Champions League regularly, Champions League weeks are really tiring. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite in favour of international breaks. I have a couple of days not working quite as hard. And assuming Sunderland don't call off a game against Oxford because we've had three international call-ups, I can go to Sunderland v Oxford next Saturday.
Interestingly, the Champions League has been really good. I don't know if I'm just saying this because now I work on it, but there have been lots of really good stories and really good games. And that has been quite a relief.
And quite tiring if you're having to write about it.
I'm getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to talk about it, mate. So...
Is it that's entirely your doing? You're the one who went to Australia.
Anyway, this domestic can continue somewhere else. We should get on with talking about the football matches and we'll start part two at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 3, Southampton 1. Timo Werner's first goal of the season. Charlie, is the Timo Werner goal bucket now ready to be filled, Max? Now is his time. I was I was so delighted, Troy. I think he's had 16 goals ruled out by VAR, normally because he's about 25 yards offside. But I have no love for Chelsea, but I was so happy he scored a goal.
Yeah, he had another one called, not offside, but chalked off on Saturday as well, didn't he? He's one of those players. He looks, for all the will in the world, he looks an excitable young man until he gets near the goal and finds out that the goal that he's just scored again is now going to be chalked off. Confidence is a wonderful thing, and confidence in a player to know that they're hitting the back of the net regularly will always make them feel that, you know, there's no way that they're going to miss an opportunity. And I actually, there's a lot about Werner I like. There's a lot about his play, his bordering on the offside kind of line is quite exciting to me. And I think he might click now. I think the confidence of that goal might help him to click. I'm still not sure about the dynamics of him, Lukaku, missing a Hudson-Odoi was there on Saturday, wasn't he? But just, I think the team needs a little bit more if it's going to compete. I think defeat against Man City was something that would have irked Tuchel because he normally gets the upper hand. But he definitely needs his front line putting the ball in the back of the net on a consistent basis. So it'll be good to see if Werner... And this is the thing about the international break that we were talking about just to start with, because he's just got a goal and now he's going to go away. And then is he going to come back with the same kind of confidence as hopefully that he would have picked up from putting the ball in the back of the net on Saturday? So it'll be an interesting one to continue to see.
And when he scored that one that was disallowed, no one went to celebrate with him, which I thought was a bit harsh. I thought surely he scored a goal, but perhaps just the Chelsea players knew that it would be disallowed for some reason, so they might as well not bother. Jay said, would Ben Chilwell's goal be a goal of the season contender, along obviously with Mo Salah and Ethan Pinnock, and not ignored by match of the day if goal line technology hadn't been needed to confirm that it went in? I think that's an interesting point, Wilson. I can't see a goal being a brilliant goal if goal line technology is necessary. It just doesn't feel, it doesn't hit the net. There's a sort of, you don't know it's gone in, and all those kind of things affect the actual, because it was a brilliant strike.
Yeah, you're right. The aesthetic is different. And then even the keeper getting a touch. I mean, here it was a very, very big touch, obviously, but
you know, yes,
the keeper getting the sort of fingertip and slightly diverting it. Even if you can't see it with the naked eye, you only see it with the replay. That does somehow detract from the goal. It probably shouldn't, because obviously the technique is exactly the same, and because the keeper's made a fraction of a closer effort to save it, shouldn't really diminish that. But I guess it depends what you're judging when you're judging what is a great goal. If it's the technique of the player striking the ball, well, it shouldn't make any difference. If it's the general aesthetic, then it does make a difference.
But I think we only judge it in general aesthetic, don't we? That's how...
Yeah, we do. And that's fine, I think. I just think we should be aware what we are judging. I think it's worth sort of reminding... it's worth having this conversation now. This is a worthwhile conversation.
We've after 4 years, we finally hit upon it.
The problem that Chilwell has is that he scored a goal on the weekend that Mo Salah has scored his goal. So all of a sudden, people will not remember the Chilwell strike as good as what it was and appreciate everything that has been said. But because Mo Salah has scored that goal now, everything else this weekend goes out the window.
And I think the point there is, imagine that Salah goal, imagine you have exactly the same run, but Ederson gets just flicks his fingertip on the way into the far post. That would just take 2% off it.
Yeah.
And that's enough to take it from being a great, great, great goal to being a good goal.
Is that the same Edison that didn't get a finger to Andros Townsend's strike a few years ago? That made that. I'm just asking. I'm just throwing it
That's
out
That's enough
there.
Of that. Yeah. We have no more nepotism on this show.
Well, I'll genuinely say that the Everton goal on Saturday was so good, I actually stood up and applauded it in my front room.
Do we have footage of that, Jonathan?
We don't, because I'm not a weird
one of all the panelists. I imagine Wilson might film him just in case he did something like a good practiced a good forward defensive, and then we'd say, I've caught it on camera. Barry, the James Ward-Prowse sending off, was that fair for you?
Yeah, I think he was a little bit unlucky. You could see what he was trying to do. He had every right to do what he tried to do, and it just mistimed it slightly. The only objection I would have is that Martin Atkinson, the referee, when he goes to look at his pitch side monitor, he's looking at it in slow motion. I think that's a little unfair on the player who's the subject of the scrutiny, but it was a red card. I don't think he was overly upset about it. I mean, interestingly, James Ward-Prowse was one of a handful of, I think, three maybe players who played every minute of every Premier League match for their team last season. So now he's missed whatever minutes of that game, and he'll miss three more now, won't he, because of his ban.
There were two lovely moments from the weekend of it's great to have fans back. One was at this game when Ben Chilwell gave away that penalty, and it wasn't just Ben Chilwell's face that said, I've given away a penalty. It was every Chelsea fan in that stand just putting their hands on their head going, oh no. The other great moment was the speed with which West Ham fans streamed out of the London Stadium when Brentford put in that winner. It was honestly like somebody had just pressed fast forward on the crowd. It was quite incredible how that many people could get into like the small alleyway to get down the steps. We'll get on to that game anyway. Spurs 2, Villa 1. Wilson, you were there. A huge win for Tottenham, this actually. There were sort of rumours over the weekend that, you know, had they not won, Nuno might have gone. And match of the day, pick this out. It's not hard to notice. Dean Smith picked it out. Heung-min Son was
brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. And I think that paper over a lot of cracks. I thought, I mean, first half was a really poor game. We were sort of at half time saying, this is really bad. I mean, lovely finish from Højbjerg for the goal. But then second half, you know, Spurs were a bit better. I don't know if it's just the confidence of being ahead. But as they pushed out a bit more, they did leave themselves open. And when Villa equalised, you did sort of think, oh, Spurs have blown it again. But yeah, the fact that they then largely through Son got the winner 4 minutes later. And Nuno mentioned that afterwards, how important it was to respond so quickly. That I think had it been 1-1 for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, both players and crowd might have got very anxious. So it was, obviously hugely important. I can't really believe they'd have sacked him after 7 games. I mean, bad as the Palace game and bad as the North London derby were, but definitely the fact that conversation was even being had was telling of the doubts people were starting to have about him. And I guess that was starting to erode the authority that he doesn't really have anyway, because everybody knows he was sort of like seventh choice or whatever. So yeah, an important win, but I think not particularly brilliant performance apart from Son.
I thought the Kane back heel to set up Lo Celso was almost, it was sort of towards Guti levels of there's no need to do this back heel, but it was lovely. But nowhere, I'm not giving him the praise that you should give Guti for two of the greatest assists football has ever seen, where it'd be easier to score a goal. Let's go to Selhurst Park, Barry. Crystal Palace 2, Leicester 2. Is this the most a camera has ever focused on Jeffrey Schlupp, Barry? Because after he came on, it was just, it's the Jeffrey Schlupp show, which is not a reality show I'd ever thought I'd watch.
Well, I think we've spoken previously on this podcast about the financial feasibility of releasing a DVD of Jeffrey Schlupp's greatest hits and goals. And obviously he's playing against his former team and scored after Leicester had made an absolute dog's breakfast trying to clear the ball. I think Leicester's defensive issues are quite the talking point, and they're not playing particularly well, but they are missing several key players: Johnny Evans, Wesley Fofana, Wilf Ndidi, James Justin. So, you know, any team is going to suffer with that kind of quality sidelined. But I thought Crystal Palace should probably have won this game. I think Leicester were lucky to get a point, and that seems to be a key or a recurring theme with Palace, not winning games they should be. But I wouldn't say it's a huge source of concern, because Patrick Vieira, I wasn't sure whether he'd be any good or not, but he seems to be creating a quite exciting young team there. And if I was a Palace fan, I'd be quite excited about it. And, you know, the results will come in time. That wasn't a bad result by any stretch of the imagination. Was also very impressed, or credit to Vieira, because it was Schlupp and Michael Elise who turned the game for Palace, and he brought them off the bench.
to the London Stadium, West Ham 1, Brentford 2. I mentioned the West Ham fans streaming out of the stadium with that 94th minute winner. I think West Ham can probably count themselves a bit unlucky. They were very good in the second half. But Troy, Brentford are really impressive, aren't they? They're a breath of fresh air, I think is the cliche you use about a team that haven't been in the Premier League before.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had the pleasure of going to see what makes Brentford tick, you know, from the boardroom to the way that they scout players a few seasons ago. And it was a real eye-opener to what they wanted to achieve, you know. And Thomas Frank is a manager with, you know, we're talking about managers, aren't we? Talking about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Nuno at Spurs. And here's Thomas Frank, who's got a philosophy. You can see it, you can identify it. His team is playing towards it. You know, you say West Ham were good in the second half. Brentford were very good in the first half and deserved probably more than what they had at half-time. They're an exciting team and they're showing no fear around being in the Premier League and the teams that they're playing. So, you know, from the 3-3 last week, you know, with Liverpool to this, they're an exciting side who, you know, they may have a bump in the road somewhere along the line, but I think they've you know, people have taken to them immediately and there's a very, very good structure about that squad and that football club that may hopefully will make them stabilise, you know, for many years to come.
Leeds beat Watford 1-0. The headline was the day after, Dell says. Are we at the point now where we should be getting weekly updates from Professor Chris Whitty and Jonathan Van Tam on who the current Watford manager is? Andrew, how long would Barry last in the Watford job? Got rid of Cisco Munoz as their head coach in the statement. The board feels recent performances strongly indicate a negative trend at a time when team cohesion should be visibly improving. The Hornets will always be grateful to Cisco for the part he played in securing last season's promotion. Wish him well for his future career in football. Richard Jolly's stat. Watford have now changed manager in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, three times, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, twice, 2020, twice, and 2021. I mean, Wilson, that's ludicrous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There was another Richard Jolly stat that Graham Taylor's first spell in charge of Watford, I think, was 428 games. Then he listed a whole, about 90 other Watford managers. He totaled 427.
Yeah, I've got it here. His first spell at Watford lasted 428 games. Watford have given Dyche, Zola, Sonino, Garcia, McKinley, Jukanovic, Sanchez Flores twice, Mazzari, Silva, Gracia, Mullins twice, Pearson, Ivic, Munoz, a combined total of 427 games. Yeah, that is one fewer. Anil says, who will succeed Claudio Ranieri as Watford manager for the final few games of this season? And Mike says, is there anything inherently wrong with going through several head coaches every season? I'm always sceptical when another one gets sacked, but it does seem to work most of the time. Wilson, this seems too hasty, or there's something wrong with recruitment.
I suppose in itself, there's nothing wrong with replacing managers regularly, but the problem is it must reduce the caliber of managers you can bring in, because who's going to go to Watford? Unless somebody thinks, you know what, yeah, I'll have 8 months at Watford between jobs. But then, you know, to what extent are they really going to be, you know, doing the job? I mean, I guess the point is the philosophy is set by the sporting director and by the board, not by the manager. And it is very much a coach, not a manager. But it just sort of feels so contrary to everything that you sort of assume to be true of football and the virtues of consistency. And the suspicion now must be, you know, as that question suggests, that they will have a third manager this season. And I don't know, do teams often start with three managers? I mean, Palace did it, didn't they, when they had Holloway and then a long gap to Tony Pulis. So he was in between them, Keith Millen?
Yeah, caretaker manager, I think.
But he's a caretaker, but he must have had five league games or something. So he was in charge for sort of a month or so.
Ranieri may not last eight games because Watford have a really tough run of fixtures coming up. I think they have to play all of the, well, Liverpool, Everton, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City, Man United, all coming up in their next eight games. He could be gone by then.
They'll have six managers, won't they?
I mean, I'll do it for a month. I think it would be fit in a month. I want to be free for Christmas, but...
But a month will do.
God, that is a run. That is a tough run, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tough run, but you've sacked a manager before that tough run to instill a manager to oversee that tough run. you know, we're just giving Palace plaudits, and Watford are have the same ident. Well, they've won more games than Palace. You know, Leicester, we're saying, are struggling, but they're above Watford. Leeds are below Watford. I don't understand the mentality here. So what is the expectation from that run of games? And I'm glad you've included Everton in there as well as really tough fixtures. So I don't understand the mentality of the next 5-6 games. What are the expectations? Because like you said, manager comes in, if it is Ranieri, if he's been announced yet, and he loses every single one of those games, then the pressure is there automatically, isn't it? And all of a sudden, if he doesn't win the two games after that, and if Barry's got the updated information on the two games after that, then if they lose those as well, like you say, he's gone. He's gone. So they could be on a third manager before Christmas.
So anyway, with apologies to those sides we haven't really discussed in detail, we will, of course, as the season progresses. Mark says, should the fourth Champions League place be awarded to the club with the highest number of vaccinated players? The Daily Mail reporting last week that only 7 of the 20 Premier League clubs have fully vaccinated more than 50% of their squads. Leeds, Wolves, Southampton and Brentford have vaccinated more than 90% of their staff. At least 3 clubs have yet to get even 10 individuals jabbed. A doctor speaking to the Mail, a club doctor, said some of the stuff they're reading and believing on the internet is incredible. Players are saying that it'll make them infertile. It's part of a plot involving Bill Gates. The pandemic is just propaganda. The real problem is that they're polluting the minds of younger players. I think what's interesting here is you saw Jurgen Klopp did a really powerful video actually at a press conference when he was talking about getting the vaccination, not just for himself, but for the community. It does seem to me that it's, and from the report in the Mail that Matt Hughes wrote, it's very much sort of whoever is the most powerful person at the club or the biggest ego, if that's the right word.
The alpha male.
People have followed Klopp at Liverpool, right? People have followed Bielsa at Leeds because of the power that they have within that club. But at other clubs where the manager doesn't necessarily have that much power, then it might be just one player who's just read a lot of WhatsApps in the afternoon. And I don't know what we do about that. I don't know if anyone has any sensible suggestion for what you do about it.
Well, I'm not sure what you can do. I don't think you can force people to inject something into their bodies if they don't want to. I would be wholeheartedly against that. I think it'd be very arrogant to presume that's okay. I live in a corner of South London that has a huge population of people from the Caribbean, or who are descendants of people from the Caribbean. A lot of them haven't taken vaccines because they have a deep mistrust of the government, and I can't say I blame them for having a deep mistrust of the government, because they've been treated appallingly by the government. I don't trust the government either, but I had the vaccines because I decided I was comfortable having it. But I wouldn't particularly criticise anyone for not having it, and I don't think it's right to try to force people to have it if they don't want to.
But we do need everyone to have it if we want the world to get back to normal.
I mean, I would be more understanding if players were concerned in terms of their fitness, in terms of their training, about putting something they don't know into their bodies. That's clearly, for athletes, is so contrary to everything they're told. They are responsible for any positive test or anything. So they have to be ultra careful. Even if they don't want to have the sort of 2 or 3 days dip after the vaccination where you're not at 100%, maybe you can't train quite as much, I would have a lot more sympathy with that. Now, maybe sympathy is the wrong word, but there's something very sad if the reason for not taking it is believing internet conspiracy theories. And that probably is where you need the clubs to take a lead in education.
Is there only a, again, I understand, because football obviously is always front page news. Is this focus around other sports as well? Or are we just hanging football out to dry here? Because I haven't heard anything mentioned. Maybe it's because I'm not in those circles, but I haven't heard anything mentioned about other sports and what is happening in those fields either.
As far as I know, and I don't really follow basketball, but certain cities in America are not letting unvaccinated players play. And on the back of that, the NBA is refusing to pay those players who don't play because they haven't been fully vaccinated. I don't think that's particularly fair either, but I think that's their contract. So I don't know what a football contract is like. Presumably there's no clause in the contract that says you have to do these, take this medicine, because this wasn't a thing when most players signed their contracts.
I mean, there was, just to Barry's point, there was talk of obviously re-engaging contracts, wasn't there, and making sure that new players that signed at clubs, their contracts kind of stipulated that. But then that would then begin also a kind of, well, what about the players that have been on existing contracts for, you know, I know players don't stick around too long anymore, but there are many that do, that are on existing contracts that doesn't have that included. So what I'm trying to say here is football needs to decide, the sporting arena needs to decide. I don't just like focusing on football. You can't just say football does it, cricket doesn't do it, or I don't know, basketball doesn't do it, or any of those other sports, netball doesn't do it. It has to be across the board, and the steer and direction has to first come from the government and then come from the sporting bodies, no?
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't feel a controversial view to me that we should be encouraging everybody to get it, because...
Well, do you think, Max, you know, players should be forced to have it?
It's a really... Do you know, it's...
See, I think I you do, but you're just afraid to say it out loud.
No, I mean, but don't you think that the pandemic is such an extraordinary situation? If we want the world to, inverted commas, get back to normal, you know, and I don't want this to sort of turn into an LBC phone-in, we need everybody to have the vaccine, and that needs to be across the world. It doesn't just need to be in Western countries. It needs to be across Earth, right? So we need everyone to do it. Do I fundamentally feel that people should be forced to have vaccinations? No. But do I feel the pandemic is such an extraordinary situation that actually I don't think I'd be up in arms if people did have to have it? No, because I'm in Sydney, my wife's in Melbourne, the borders are closed. I can't, you know, my wife is however many weeks pregnant, I'd quite like to see her and I can't. Now, that's a very selfish reason to want people to get vaccinated, but I can't if the people in New South Wales and Victoria don't get 80% of them don't get vaccinated. You know, they won't open the borders.
It didn't take you long in Australia to adopt their authoritarian tone on things like this.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three will do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Baz, you watched Atleti Barca. And I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that Barca lost again.
No, they were thoroughly outplayed. They lost 2-0, but it was as comfortable a 2-0 as you will ever see. I think what struck me about this game was just how absolutely ordinary the Barcelona starting 11 looked. I can't remember seeing a more unremarkable Barcelona team in my lifetime, as long as I've been watching football. So much so that there were several players in the lineup I'd never heard of.
I mean, West Brom is a team you famously don't know any players from, isn't it? So are you saying Barcelona over new West Brom?
Well, probably, because I think now with the wage cap that's been imposed on them by La Liga, they probably have a similar budget for playing staff to West Brom. But yeah, they rallied a little bit in the second half, but when Ansu Fati came on, he's clearly a player, but it was... And to be fair, they did have a lot of players out injured, but they were... It was a 2-0 thrashing, let's say.
Also in La Liga, Real Madrid lost 2-1 against Espanyol. Bayern lost at home to Eintracht Frankfurt. PSG lost at Rennes. That's the thing about these foreign leagues. The big sides just win all the time. In the Premier League, anyone can beat anyone, can't they? Jack says, is there anything funnier than Sunderland fans travelling 14 hours on a round trip to watch their team lose 4-0 in effectively a swimming pool? Wilson?
Well, Sunderland's home form this season is excellent. 6 wins out of 6. The away form, 4 points from 4 now. I have to say, I was not optimistic before that game, but to be 3-0 down at half-time is never great. And I did quite like Lee Johnson's attempts to get the game called off at 4-0 down. I suspect that ship might have sailed, but no, the conditions weren't great, but Sunderland were comfortably beaten before it became farcical. So, yeah, just suck it up and get on with it.
Wrexham's game was called off, even though they were 2-0 up in the second half at Aldershot. Cambridge legend Paul Mullin, there's a great photo of him trying to dry an entire waterlogged pitch with a hand towel. It was a futile experiment, padding around with one towel. Max asks, is Wilson aware that the season two finale of Ted Lasso is entitled Inverting the Pyramid of Success?
I was not aware of that, no.
Yeah. Are you going to sue them?
I don't think I can. I don't think I've got any copyright on a phrase that was in common usage well before I named an excellent book after it. Still available. Still get it.
Yeah.
Still available.
Well, we were very critical of Ted Lasso from just watching 4 seconds of the trailer. And I think we've, although I don't know if any of us have seen it, because I don't think I've got Apple TV. It's meant to, it's won everything, hasn't it? So we were categorically wrong.
Well, it's had very good reviews, but I've also been told by people that I would hate it. So anyway, I appreciate the efforts they're making to try and get me involved. In the same way, I appreciate the way Endeavour, despite this probably being the worst season of Endeavour, has featured football pretty prominently in all three episodes.
Lee says, the only thing anybody wants is butternut squash recipes and serving suggestions. Please, Pat was in touch. Hello to the pod. Butternut squash is a staple side dish of Thanksgiving in New England, where I'm originally from. You can boil and mash it like potatoes and add some cinnamon. Similarly, pureeing it into soup is delicious. You can also cut it into cubes and roast the squash like potatoes. I would also recommend butternut squash risotto and butternut squash ravioli in brown butter. I think Mark Langdon would really enjoy vegetables at an American Thanksgiving dinner because the basic premise is to slather them in unreasonable amounts of butter. Cheers from Washington, D.C. Vamos, DC United. Peter says, perhaps you could ask Guardian columnist Yotam Ottolenghi to make a special pod appearance to tell Barry and Mark how to cook a butternut squash. Barry, you bought a butternut squash. Ross says, did Bazza cook the pumpkin? Listeners keen to know what you did with it.
I drew a face on it. And now, because I did that, I've grown quite attached to it.
Because, oh dear.
And I can't bring myself to carve it up or cook it. Because it's my friend.
What have you called it? I mean, presumably Wilson is normally the name given to inanimate objects that keep very lonely people company.
Well, I hadn't named it, but yeah, Wilson will do. Wilson the butternut squash.
I would recommend you skin me, slather me in olive oil and a bit of chili and garlic and roast me for about, I don't know, 40 minutes on 180.
Okay, well, maybe I'll go and buy another one because I can.
Well, I'm not damaging this one.
I feel like we've done enough today, everybody. Thanks so much for your time, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Troy.
Always a pleasure.
Me and Barry are joined by Paul Merson tomorrow, who's written a book, and it's very interesting, and it talks about everything that he has been through in his career, during his football career and afterwards. And we'll talk to him about that and also about the failed pilot that the three of us did for Sky Sports, which is somewhere in the vaults. And I think it would make an excellent TV show. Nobody at Sky
did. It was certainly better than the programmes that were commissioned instead of it, which have since been cancelled.
I agree.
This is The Guardian.